Right. Okay, so this is Jessica Lancia. It is December 11th, 2010. We are at the Shake Rag in Melrose, Florida. And we are interviewing Helen. Helen, would you state your full name and date of birth for the record, please?
Helen Gay Mabry, M-A-B-R-Y, Miller.
And your date of birth?
Date of birth, July 2nd, 1941.
And also in the room is Barbara Esrig. Would you state your name just so that we can tell who's who?
Okay, my name is Barbara Esrig.
Excellent. All right. If you want to state your date of birth, you can or cannot. Doesn't matter.
5/1/47.
All right. So y'all are almost contemporaries. Not really. Okay. Well, Helen, it's an honor to do this interview with you. I'm excited to hear what you have to say. And I guess, where were you born? Let's start from the beginning. And why don't you start with where you were born and what that was like growing up?
Well, I was born in West Virginia. And my mother had had about 14 pregnancies. Only 8 children lived, and I was the last. I was the baby of the family. I have a sister who still tells me that. And growing up, it was in a coal mining town. My father was a coal miner. Mm-hmm. He had also been a moonshiner when things were tough. In West Virginia.
Where in West Virginia is that?
It's in the southern part of West Virginia, McDowell County, and the little town was Premier.
Premier.
Mm-hmm. It was the next biggest town was Welch. And then during the early times, Welch had 2 theaters, and it was called Little New York. Such as it were, I never saw any of New York in it, but it was fascinating when I was a child.
And what's the population of that town, you know?
Well, they had a sign up, and they probably still have the same sign up. When you go from Premier to Welch, you go through, at the time, it was the deepest man-made cut for the highway, US 52. And so you go through there and go into the big town of Welch, Little New York. That's probably doesn't have too much. It's just about defunct, really. It's with the demise of the coal mining industry, things sort of went downhill after that for the little shops and everything that were there. So with 2 theaters, you know, if you got 50 cents together and the cab driver felt sorry for the kids, we could go to the movie, buy a box of popcorn, watch the show, and get taken back home by the one person taxi cab. So it was pretty fascinating. Another thing that was that I think now was great about West Virginia, it drew so many cultures in to work in the coal mines. So in the little town, you got the Italian accent, sometimes French. I found that to be, well, not so interesting when I was growing up, but later on, it was really nice to be able to meet this mishmash of people who had come in to work in the coal mines. But also, when we hit probably the late 50s, the coal mines started to close down, a lot of them. And I think maybe there's still one open in that particular county. But my father worked in the coal mines. He also worked in the bar at night. And he tend to come home, you know, a little on the tippy side. when he got home, he had had a beer or a few. And as I say, they during the Depression, they did make moonshine, and my mother drove a car. He did not. So she ran the moonshine, and he made the moonshine.
Did they ever explain why it was that she drove and he didn't?
I guess maybe he just didn't want to drive. I don't know. He was half-blood, Cherokee, and his mother was full-blood, too. So that part of the culture is there. We had a lot of people, who came in to work in the coal mines. So they, at the time, paid $3 a day, and that was excellent money. And with that $3 a day, the coal miner, they gave them tools, but they didn't really know until they started working that they had to pay the coal company back for their pick and axe and shovel. So it was a fun thing. And now when I go back, and I don't go often, but it's pretty fascinating in that they had a couple of big trestles that the coal trains would come up on and go across. And they also had a line that broke off that was right above my house. House was down in the valley where it would flood sometimes. Water mm-hmm. would come up under the house. And these were coal company-owned houses. So they didn't do a lot to them.
What was the influence of the coal company on the town? I know in a lot of sort of mill towns in the south, the mill company would actually own the town yeah. and would rent the buildings out to mm-hmm. their workers. Was that the similar experience?
Yes, they owned the houses. They, I'm sure, took rent from their working in coal mines. They also owned the company store where you bought most of your clothes and shoes and food. So they really pretty much got most of what you worked for back.
Right.
So,
did you ever get a sense of how your parents felt about the sort of the overarching arm of the coal mine business in their lives?
Well, not early on, I didn't. I knew my dad worked, you know, two jobs, but we never saw a lot of his money. So, you know, he spent it, he hid it. We found, the big thing was to look for the hiding place, you know, take a dollar or two out. He'd hide it under the floorboards. He made a bank one time and nailed it to the floor and burned a hole in the top. So my older sister and I figured if we chewed some bubble gum and put it on a string, if we fished properly, we would get some of the change out. It was different, maybe growing up there, but I didn't know it. Everybody was relatively poor,
yeah.
So you know everybody was in the same shape as your family was usually. And being the last child, I'm sure I got more things than the older kids did. So, and I was the only one who finished high school, and then 10 years later, I started taking classes in college and finished an associate's degree. So,
were you in West Virginia during this whole time between college and high school?
No, just high school. I left right after high school. I had a friend who was a nurse, and her son moved to Alexandria, Virginia. And I got an opportunity to go to the big city. And I worked there. I also got married there and was married for almost 10 years, about 9 years. I had two daughters. One was a nurse, and the other one went to school in the seventh grade, and I think she was possessed by somebody else's mind because she was a real hill raiser, you know. And if there was anything to get into, she managed. But the other one was pretty tame, and still is. And this one, you know, has a lot of health problems now, I think, because of early behavior. But they're both, you know, Jennifer lives in St. Augustine, Melissa lives in Cartersville, Georgia. That's the older one.
In where?
Cartersville, Georgia. It's right outside of Atlanta, maybe 45 minutes. But as a child, I was quite the tomboy. I didn't like the dolls, and my mother always cleaned them up after I tied a rope or something around their neck and washed their little clothes and hung them up in the corners in the living room. And I always thought they looked like little dead things, so I'd run by them real fast. I didn't have anything to do with them. But she finally got it. She bought me a set of six guns, and the holsters were black, and they were like Lash LaRue's, who was my cowboy hero. So,
do you remember when that was that you got this?
Probably guns? I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, and I'd wear them to town when we went into the Welch, And there was always a little old man, little black eyes, really sweet. And he would be sitting in the alleyway because the cab came down this particular alleyway and you caught the cab back home, taxi back home. But he was, I think he just sat there a lot, and he always had a bag of grapes. And he'd say, and I'd look at my mom and say, can I go? And she said, yeah. And he'd give me a little handful of grapes. And you know, being in a coal town, we had a lot of blacks, a lot of Italians, some French, and a bunch of hillbillies. If they weren't when they got there, they were when we finished with them. So, so it was an interesting place culturally, I think, to be raised in.
Mm-hmm. Was everyone pretty congenial?
Mm-hmm.
Was everyone pretty congenial?
Pretty much so. Yeah.
Who did you make friends with, sort of the kids you would interact with? Were they all of these different backgrounds? Could you interact with the black kids and the Italians and the French or the hillbillies, or who were you?
They didn't. There was one black family that lived in the little hall that we lived in, and his parents wouldn't let him play with us. And my mother probably was the only one in the neighborhood that had two black friends that would visit, and they were the most gorgeous women I think I remember them, that I'd ever seen. They were mixed, and they're beautiful. And they'd come and they'd talk, and I'd just listen, you know. That's where I learned all my bad words.
From these women, or
from
your mother?
From my mother and the women. They were trying pretty much in this alternate language that I have been known when I get mad to use it. So.
Can I just ask you one question? What was the population again of?
Well, 6,603. Okay. Is what the sign said.
In Welsh, but you're from
in
Premier.
Welsh. Premier, yeah.
Premier, which
and
is
it was
smaller?
Just basically they would name people lived in, you know, the valleys, more or less, where the mountains came down, and there would be houses on each side. And when you went to drive from Premier to Welsh, you went through this cut that they had cut in the road so it didn't go straight up the hill and down. You would see more, you know, more people. But the little towns had hollows where the mountains came together, and there'd be a number four hollow and number one hollow. We were lucky. We lived on right by this federal highway, U.S. Highway 52, that went through. And not that that made a lot of difference, except there was a big curve, and about once every year or so, someone would come around the curve going too fast and end up, you know, over in the on the creek side or down on the other side. And my mother always loved to rescue. So, you know, she'd go with them and round up somebody who would drive them to the hospital, because by the time you called an ambulance, it may be 3 or 4 hours by the time they got there, because I think they had one serving, you know, the whole county. So, but there were 3 hospitals in Welsh when I was growing up. So it said something about the size of the town. And now there's only one. And the company store and the old post office has been torn down. So that was rather saddening to go back and see that. And when I went to grade school, we walked to school and we walked along the railroad track down, and then we'd cross the track, go up and go across a bridge over the highway. Well, on Thursdays, when we got out of school, it was the one day that the steam engine with a line of coal cars, they'd bring an empty, take back the full ones. And, you know, you could always feel the ground shake. And I hated walking along because it was like, you know, a little path, maybe from over here or to the wall, and the tracks were over here.
So
and
like
we would walk
six
the tracks when the train wasn't coming and see how far we could walk on the rails. But it was, you know, it didn't take much to entertain us. as children. We all get together, and our favorite thing was to get a hatchet or an axe, and we were going to make a log cabin, and we'd chop on every tree, I think, in the forest. But we'd always get it about this high, and none of us knew how to make a roof, so.
So there's this general idea that people growing up in the 50s had very sort of strict gender identities, that if you were a girl, you were supposed to act a certain way, and if you're a boy, you're supposed to act a certain way, and that the idea, at least in the history books, is that this sort of became more flexible as time went on. It doesn't sound like, from what you're saying, with your mother.
I wasn't caught in that at all. Maybe my mother was too tired after having all those children, or maybe she was just, she always said that I was different than the other kids. And I remember her saying once when I was visiting my sister in Maryland, and she was living with her at the time, and somebody said my name, and she was starting to get a little forgetful, and she says, "Now, Helen Gay." I sure named her right, didn't I? So that was interesting. So I have no idea where the middle name came from. But my first name was after one of her sisters, whose name was Helen. And she traveled. Her husband was I don't know what he did for the government, but he always says he was an attaché, and they were in Budapest and in parts of Russia and in Brazil. And I don't know whether he was what an attaché meant at that time.
Where did your mother come from?
She was born in Denver, Colorado. And I imagine that when the coal mines opened in West Virginia, it pulled in a lot of different people. And
was your father, did they move to West Virginia together, or did she move there independently and meet him there?
She met him there. He was from Hillsville, Virginia. And he came in to work in the coal mines too, of course. And
so she actually worked in the mines?
She didn't work in the mines, no. When things got tough, she would take in washing and ironing or around Christmas time to make sure the kids, you know, got a present and that type of thing. And
how was the laundry done back then?
Well, they had, at first she just heated water in a tub on the cook stove, and she'd lift that off, and she'd have another tub of water with cold water, and she'd wash them on the washboard and then rinse them and hang them out. And then we got a washing machine. It had a wringer on it, and the motor wasn't covered. It just sat on crossbars at the bottom of the washing machine. So then she had that. But I'd seen her hang clothes on the line in the winter where they would freeze before she would get them from the line. And I was the only, I had a brother, but he wasn't worth that much help to her. So I could chop wood for her, and I'd go pick coal from the slate dump where they have coal mixed in sometimes, and bring her a wagon load home, and then we would buy it from the coal company when we could pry the money out of Dad. So it was a different kind of life. There were some bad parts, but mostly when you're a kid, you don't always look at those parts, you know. I can remember, for instance, wearing shoes to school that had holes in the bottom, and we'd put cardboard in there. And of course, if the ground was wet, and cardboard gets wet too. But you live through those things, didn't we?
Was it a one-room schoolhouse, or was it a
no? We had mixed grades. I think first and second were together, third and fourth, and then fifth and sixth. And then we were bused into the little town of Welch, who had, seventh grade through 12th grade, and they bus kids in from all around. So that was interesting. And I had one teacher that I really liked. I think I may have had a crush on her, but her name was Jeanette Bivens. And I kept in touch with her. I'd send her a card and stuff every year, and she'd always send me a little note back. And I sent her a piece of poetry that I'd written about West Virginia, and she wrote back a letter and says it's nice to have someone writing something nice about West Virginia. So, you know, you had those kind of things, teachers that you liked and then teachers that, just like kids today, you didn't particularly care for. But she was my hero in teaching because she got me interested in journalism and writing. So I took English from her, and then she also did the high school newspaper. And then I got on the staff of the newspaper when I got in the 10th grade. So that's where I started writing some.
No. And then you decided to move to the big city.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it was a decision. You know, in my family, all the kids left when they turned a certain age. And nobody ever said that, you know, you're supposed to leave. It's just that I knew this nurse that worked at the hospital when I did. I got a job at the hospital right after in the medical records section. And she was moving. She was taking her son, and her husband was going to join her 4 or 5 months later. And so I lived with them a little while after he came, and then I rented an apartment, and then I stupidly got married. What people told you were supposed to do. You're supposed to grow up and get married, and Prince rides in on the horse, and you know, 4 or 5 years later, he rides out if you're lucky.
So what was your experience being married to a man?
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of it was I was doing what I thought I was supposed to do, you know? And then I had the 2 children, and I think I may have married him because when I met his family, I thought they were wonderful. His sister was married to a doctor, and I was really impressed by that. So I probably married thinking...
You married up.
It was the most dysfunctional family I ever... I mean, my family, I thought, may have been dysfunctional, but they put the funk in the dysfunctional. I got a divorce when... Well, we were living in Fort Walton Beach, I suppose. I overdosed. I'd had enough. The lady asked me the next day, why did you do this? And I said, I was just fucking tired.
Now, what year was that?
Oh, gosh, I don't... You know, I've sort of just... I've been divorced 30-some years, so it would be late 70s, early 80s.
So when Walton Beach in...
Walton Beach, Florida.
Florida. I'm not familiar with Florida geography very much.
Well, it's in the Panhandle. It's right near Pensacola. It was really a nice town.
And why had y'all moved there?
He had gone to South Florida and gotten a job. And I was still in Louisiana. Then we moved over.
You were still in
Wait,
Louisiana.
Wait, we didn't get to yeah. Louisiana. We were in Virginia.
Louisiana. If I never saw Louisiana again, it wouldn't bother me any. But we lived there, while we were living there, I think it was, I just got tired. I was just so tired, and I overdosed.
On what?
He was always taking pills. He'd go out to work one day, and then he might call you because he went to the hospital because he was sick.
Oh.
Well, when I divorced him, you know, the hospital doors are real shiny and heavy. He went into the bathroom. And he had gone into the bathroom. And I happened to look at the door for some reason. And he was doing deep knee bends. And then he would come back in and call the nurse, take the thermometer and rub it on the sheet to get a fever going for attention. And so after I did my little deed of stupidity, he came by and he stuck his head in the door and says, it's time for me to straighten up and come home. I said, you don't come home. And that was it. He didn't. So, and I finally bought a house. They had something like farm home loans. And it wasn't a farm home. It was just who had the money. So I talked, I was taking a government, class on government, and talked to the teacher one day. And he says, well, where do you live? And I said, we have an apartment. I'd like to have a house. He says, well, the federal home farm group have extra money. Call them. And I did, and they had a house. And probably the biggest thing I did was leave Fort Walton, because I really fell in love there with a woman. And it just didn't work out, you know. It was on and off and in and out, and I had two kids. I didn't need somebody coming in and out.
How old were the kids now?
Well, probably 3 and 6 or 7. And, but she did the cardinal thing. She sent this guy that we both worked with and told me that, well, she just doesn't want to do that anymore. So I just went shit crazy, and I said, if that's what love is all about, then I'll just, you know, do what I want to do. And I had went through 4 or 5 little sexual affairs with girls, ladies, women, but I still think about her.
Do you remember your first time, like when you first sort of decided to go from maybe just thinking about it to actually acting on it?
Well, I always knew, even from high school, that I would look at girls, women, but I never, well, for a while I didn't really understand. I knew it was different than what, but when I met Peggy, well, first of all, she flirted with me. And she'd do things like, we went to New Orleans for a weekend, and when she got the keys, she held them up and jingled them, you know. And she'd do little things like that. Well, finally, you know, she'd come out to the house, and then, so one night I decided, well, I might go out and go into a gay bar. I'd never been to a gay bar before. And I had a male friend, J.O., who was going. So I got her to babysit. I come home about 2 o'clock in the morning, you know. I'd gone in this bar. I was nervous. I spilled my drink. And I went in the bathroom, and some lady wanted to show me her gallbladder operation scar. I don't know.
Now, where was this?
In Pensacola. We were in Fort Walton Beach, and the bar was in Pensacola.
And how old were you around that thing?
Well, I had the two kids, so I was probably 34, 33. Probably more, yeah.
And so before that, you'd never had any sort of...
Oh, I'd had a lot of inclinations, but I just didn't do anything
about
it.
Act on it.
Mm-hmm. But when I came home that night, Peggy was in my bed asleep. So I said, do you mind if I sleep here? And I did. And then just one day, one thing led to another, and we were sitting on the couch one day, and I said, may I kiss you? And she didn't say anything, so I did. And, you know, and I was just head over heels from then on. But when she sent, and I don't know if she sent him or not, or whether she was just talking to him, and he chose to tell me she didn't want to do that anymore. But it made me really angry, because I thought, you know, I would do anything to be near her, even if it was just a friendship. Well, I'd try anyway. I don't know how good I would have been at it, but I'd try. So, you know, now she just doesn't. I sent her a card. But she has her sister. She moved in, Attila the Hunt, and sister. And I think she's the yard dog or something. And my name must be on the shit list, because... I called her, and she said, well, it's been 30 years. And I thought, how the fuck do you know it's been 30 years? You know, but I don't know. One of these days, I'm just going to drive over there and just act the shit out or something.
Is she still in Pensacola?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, she'll never. Well, she's from Fort Walton Beach. She'll never live in anywhere else, I don't believe.
And she's married to a man?
No.
No.
No, never married. She lives with her sister.
And so what did you do after you decided that this was over with Peggy?
Well, after I'd gone out and gotten so mad and screwed around with, you know, everyone I thought wanted to, all the women anyway, I thought, you know, this is tiring. I can't keep doing this. And it gets where it's not even fun. You don't even know who the hell they or what they are. I think a couple of them were a little on the crazy side. But then, you know, after I met this one woman who was probably crazy as a ball, she moved to Pensacola with me. I just up and moved. I sold my house. I didn't even get anything out of it. I don't know. I think I got taken for a ride by this woman who sold it. And then I would call her sometimes and tell her what I was doing. I think to aggravate her, and she, I think that may be why she doesn't talk to me ever again. But I sent her a card a while back, and I think her sister returned it. So, but I'm, you know, one of these days going to ask her if she felt the need to for protection by moving Matilda the Hun in, or... what? But I guess it's not nice to be vicious in these days.
She's probably scared about her feelings, her own feelings.
I think she is, because she said one time, well, you knew I always come back. But I didn't know that. She never told me she always came back. And always coming back is very disrupting if you have children. They don't understand it. You don't understand it. And I don't even think she understood it. So, you know, what do you do? And then I met Vi and I've lived together probably 33 years now. But, you know, I really don't know what I'd ever do. Peggy talked to me and says, let's get together and talk. I have no idea what I would do. Because Vi is not a touchy-feely person. I am, you know, I like for every once in a while to somebody for her to come by and hug me or something. And she's just not that kind of person. I'll do it to her, and she doesn't mind, I guess. She doesn't respond one way or the other. And I do care for her a lot. I have to. I've lived with her that long. Why wouldn't I? But you still have this thing sometimes back there, and it won't go away.
Yeah, you think back to that one person and the what if. So Peggy is sort of symbolizes maybe, I don't know if you would say it this way, but a transition from one stage of your life to another.
Well, that and more.
Mm-hmm. She's the one you'll never forget.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just, of course, you know, I could put out a hitman on Attila the Hun. No, teasing.
Can I?
But she really was. She was a music teacher. Couldn't play the piano very well for shit. She didn't have a rhythm, but she could direct a choir, you know. And I even went to see her a couple of times. I mean, see her. And she never acknowledged me being there, so that pissed me off. So, thus, moved to Pensacola with the Bride of Frankenstein, I think.
Well, you know, you mentioned music. With music, if we can just sort of go in a different direction for a little bit. When did music come into your life? Because you're an amazing musician.
When my brother got the guitar and they told me I couldn't touch it.
Now, how old were you then?
About 7. I couldn't reach around the neck of the guitar, so I'd pick out songs with my thumb and lay it down flat. And then I learned to play by ear. You know, I know a lot of different chords, but I have no idea what the names of them are. I don't really. It's not necessary if you play by ear, I guess. But I enjoy that. I've really forced myself this last week to just go down to the cottage and play for an hour or two. And that's been nice. Because, you know, I'm a musical-minded person. I like music. I like to play music at home. I like to listen to music. But by just content reading the book, and she doesn't seem to mind if I'm playing music, but she doesn't seem to care about stereo being on or something like that. So I usually go down to the cottage and do the music stuff.
So was music pretty important in your childhood? I mean, were there a lot of people that played music around? Did the coal miners come back and play, or did you sit on the porch and play?
I sat on the porch a lot and play, and I remember two or three of my sisters sitting on the porch singing harmony. And somebody asked me, well, Pat, Paul's sister, says, how did you learn to sing harmony? Well, I don't know. I just would listen to them sitting out there singing. And then, you know, when I got to where I could play the guitar, I played at Shake Rag for a while. As a matter of fact, I probably started playing when Cherie was alive across the street. But, you know, they've got people begging to come in and play. So I don't come here and play anymore that much.
She's an amazing musician.
Mm. Well, proper different, because I don't know what I'm doing. But, you know, I thought once, I said, you know, I probably should study music. And I thought, no, that would mess up whatever style I've developed for myself. So I never did take any lessons. And I learned to play a little bit on the banjo and lap dulcimer.
So what's your favorite kind of music to play and to listen to?
You know, I like a variety of music, and it depends on the mood I'm in sometimes. I love blues, and I like some of the country music. And you know, nowadays you listen to the radio, and I have no idea who these kids are coming up singing. I mean, I know Taylor Smith, whatever she is, Swift, I think, because, you know, she's got out cards and everything else, but I never really listened to her. So,
do you remember growing up, who were your big musical influences?
Yeah, my brother learned to play from a guy who lived 4 or 5 houses up the hollow from us, and he was really good, and he played, so I would watch them when they played, and try to develop a picking strum like he did. It's sort of like a Chet Atkins type of thing, but I don't use finger picks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Usually. I like naked finger playing, I guess. So.
What was it, did you listen to on the radio that you liked? Like, that was the rage,
oh,
Elvis
gosh.
Presley and the Beatles.
I listened to Elvis, I listened to Patsy Cline.
Did they have bluegrass there?
Yeah, they did some bluegrass, but I didn't know anybody who really played the banjo. I just bought one once at the office when I was working in Jacksonville for $50, and I took it apart, and I looked at it, and she says, "You'll never get that back." Well, all I did was take it apart and clean it and put new strings on it. And, you know, alter, adjust the keys and things. I thought, yeah, well, and I just started picking around on it and found out where the sounds were that I liked, and that's how I'm going to play the banjo. Probably about the same way I'm going to play the guitar.
So, it seems like you've moved a lot. We've already been to Fort Walton, Pensacola.
That's when I was married, yeah.
Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
Which, where in Louisiana?
Near New Orleans.
Near New Orleans.
And this little town called Metairie. That's right outside of New Orleans.
And then we were, for a little bit, we were in Alexandria.
That was before I was married. When I left home, I moved, and I lived in Alexandria for a while. Then I lived on the Maryland side. That was the Virginia side of Washington, D.C. It just sort of encompasses a lot of the little towns. And then I lived on the Maryland side when I met sperm donors, what my daughter calls it. I met a sperm donor there. She is so bad. My oldest daughter has a sick sense of humor like I do. So she says, Mom, she calls several years ago. He died 4 or 5 years ago from some type of stomach aneurysm or something. But his sister said he married 10 times. I says, well, that's all right. But he had one wife that I really understood. And I think it may have been the first one he married. He would, when he got unhappy, he would sort of ride you. Oh, you're not good. You don't know anything about this and that, and so on and so forth. So I'd been through that. So she called me one night, about 2 a.m, and she said, I'm gonna jump the 17th story apartment. And I said, Nikki, you won't do that. He's not worth that. She had gone to, he was a manager of some apartment. She had gone down to take him lunch, came to the door in his underwear. So I must have talked to her 4 or 5 hours that night. I mean, she called around 2, and I was still talking to her at 8. And I thought everything's okay. But 3 days later, my boss called me in, and my sister-in-law called her, said Nikki jumped.
Wow.
And I was so angry because I could just hear him, you know.
So he was sort of verbally abusive and unfaithful.
Yeah, and unfaithful. Verbally abusive, but not much to, you know. I got mashed once and threw every can in the cabinet. I was aiming for the head, but I must not have been as mad as I thought I was because I never hit him in the head. But maybe he was good at ducking, I don't know.
So how did your children react to the news that, well, one, he was gone, and two, that you were now moving in with another woman?
Well, I wasn't living with him when I moved in with Peggy. Well, I never really moved in with Peggy. She would just come and spend the night with me. I would go in the kitchen, I'd go over there and spend the night with her. So we never really lived together.
Mm-hmm. But they knew what was going on, that it was more than a friendship?
I never told them. They never asked. They loved her. She played, you know, the piano, and she would teach them, you know, little note songs. And she was very good at that.
What about when you moved with that other woman to Pensacola?
And Boudreaux. Boudreaux. They didn't like her, and I think she was, maybe when I wasn't there, she worked in a motel or a hotel desk clerk at night a lot. And so sometimes she was there and they were there when I was working because I worked for the state regular daytime hours. And Melissa told me, years after, she said, you know what Ann Boudreaux told me? She told me if it wasn't for me, she wouldn't be leaving. And this was, you know, 5 or 6 years later. I didn't even know where she was, much less I'd be able to confront her.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Ring a neck. But that's a horrible thing to say. Mm-hmm. So, but that was, I think that was just a, it was the stupidest thing I ever did, was to leave my home in Fort Walton and move to Pensacola. Because we didn't stay together maybe almost a year. And she was always, you know, I found out later because people would tell me afterward. It was a black woman called me that she worked with, a really sweet lady. And she said, honey, she was messing around all over the place. And she, and apparently she was, you know. But I think it was just a rebound thing that I got involved with her. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, I certainly didn't miss her that much when she left. So.
Did you all leave? Where did you go after that? You moved into her house, correct?
No, we rented a house in Pensacola. And I bought a house after that.
In Pensacola?
Yeah. Yeah. We had lived downtown Pensacola. Well, no, we did move and rented a house for a while. And then when she left, I had a friend who, he worked in farm home loans and housing, and he called me and said, you know, you need to, if you want to buy a house, you need to come out here now and apply. And luckily, you know, I was able to get one. And that's when Peggy started working for the state. She finally went back to teaching. So after that, it just didn't seem to work. So, you know, you think about those things and the people that you care for, mm-hmm. you know, no matter what, where you are.
Yeah.
It's, you said that you finished high school, you're the first child that finished high school, and then a few years later, you started taking classes. Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of marketable skill did you get eventually? What kind of work did you go into?
Well, at first, I was already working. As a matter of fact, one of the social workers was one got me to go and apply for college because I think one of the places in town had gotten grant money, and I applied and got it.
Now, where did you run into a social worker?
I worked in the Child Protective Services Unit for the state.
Well, that was right out of high school you did that? I mean,
right after I got married. I mean, right after I...
But no
schooling. Right before I got a divorce, I started working for him. So, I worked in Fort Walton Beach, then I worked in Pensacola, and then when I met Vi, they wanted to transfer over here, her over here, she worked. Well, first it was, she worked for a paper company, and I think at the time as she was retiring, another company bought them. It was like the third or fourth company. It had been St. Regis, and it was Champion and something else, and it was International Paper Company was the last one. So they transferred her job to Jacksonville. So that's how we ended up over here. And I just transferred with the state. So
you went into Child Protective Services. I mean, that's interesting.
That was the first one.
Considering your background and your experience with your husband, was there a way or a reason why you went into Child Protective Services?
That was just the job that was open. That was just the job that was open. After I transferred to Pensacola, I was in the Medicaid unit for a while, and, you know, went into nursing homes and things like that and did audits to make sure they were, you know, following the rules, the government rules. And then I ended up in vital statistics. And after I worked there for a few years, I went into the field program, and I covered 23 counties doing mostly death registration and training, birth registration, you know, it was not that complicated. The thing with them was just getting them in time, and same thing with the death certificates, but I visited more funeral homes than I did hospitals. And they always wanted to show you the casket room. I'm not ready yet unless I can take a nap.
So you work pretty much for the state.
I worked 30 years.
For the State Department.
Yeah.
What is the State Department?
Well, it was the Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services.
Interest.
Oh, right.
And then they changed the name to Department of Children and Family Services, and, you know, it was all still the same type of section.
So did you have a degree in sociology or something?
I was just working on a degree. For a long time, I didn't go out. I just worked in the office. And then I started going out and training for death registration in particular. Mm-hmm. How important, you know, it is. They had 5 days. And, of course, they were usually late because the doctors never, you know, they'd sign when they'd sign, and you could call them and threaten to fine them and everything else. And usually, if it got nasty enough, they'd send it in. But we waited to, you know, families need those things, you know, when people die, because they need mental closure as much as they do financial, you know, type of things that may be connected. So
did you talk to the families of the deceased a lot? Or did you?
Not a lot. The only interaction I usually had with the families was if they were looking for birth certificates that we were having a hard time getting. But because medical examiners were the worst, because they always, you can file a pending record, a medical examiner can, or a doctor can if they, have to have a cause of death and the primary site, you know, if someone had cancer, they want to know whether it was in their toe or in their eye, you know, or brain. But those were the things I dealt with mostly there, and traveling and doing training classes, mm-hmm, for primarily funeral directors, and each county has a chief deputy registrar in vital statistics. So, and I'd work with them sometimes to train or take them with me when I was training people in their area.
Were you out as lesbian at work?
But yeah, I figured if they weren't paying, if you know, they weren't paying my bills, they didn't. I never had trouble. I really didn't, and I didn't hide it from the beginning.
But so the beginning was sort of 1980 or around then.
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the mid to late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. I'm not good with dates. I just wander along through life saying, well, it's 1910. No, it's 2010.
It was around then. So how did you meet Vi? What's the story of meeting
Vi? There was a friend that she had that I knew vaguely. I didn't know her too much because she was pretty rowdy. And we had gone to a movie one night, and when we came out, Vi had been to the movie with them. And the kids, when they were in the movie, said they knew the people she was sitting with. And they said, Mommy, can we want to go down and sit with them? So I asked them, and they said, yeah. So their movie ended up, it was one of these dual things. It was about 5 minutes before us, so they just waited for us to come out. And she was sort of standing in the background. And later on, I called the people and I said, could you give me her number? I'd like to call her and see if she'd like to go out to dinner or something. And after, 20 questions, they finally gave me her number, and I called her, and we met that way.
Did you have a sense that she was interested in women or in you?
Well, I knew she had lived with another woman. I think she only lived with another woman. She said she was had told this guy she would marry him once, and on a Sunday afternoon he lay down on her couch watching a football game and fell asleep, and the more she looked at him, finally woke him up and told him she wasn't marrying him to go home and stay. So that's why. So, no, she had never been married.
But you knew this at the time, like mm-hmm. when you were...
Yeah, when I first met her, she told me she had never been married. So, but she lived by herself at that time. And I think the woman she had lived with before had moved somebody in there to stay. And she got interested in the other woman, not by it, but the person she was living with. And finally moved out.
So how long have you and Vi been together now?
32 years.
And you were divorced for how many years before that?
Well, I was probably divorced maybe 10 years because Peggy came in there somewhere. Toward, you know, before I met Vi.
32 years went by. So when did y'all move to Melrose?
We first moved to Jacksonville because she got transferred over there with the paper company. And we came down to visit, do you know Dory Rotunda?
Sure.
We came down to visit Dory, and she was living in this log cabin. We said, if you ever decide to sell this, let us know. And sure enough, about 8 or 10 years later, she decided to sell it, and she called. So I said, well, how about if we go down there for 2 or 3 weekends and see how we like it? And we did. We came down, and Dory had 40-watt bulbs in every... So we'd change the light bulbs when we came down, and then we'd change them back when we left. And she had this black curtain, you know, where you walk into the kitchen, there's an opening this way and then a little angle thing. Well, she had a black curtain up there. So we'd take down that damn curtain every time we came down, put it back up where we had. So finally she was ready to sell it, and we bought it. She said first, well, I don't know if I'll sell it or not. And we said, well, go show it to some other people. So we took all of our money and went to Arizona and just had a real good time. Came back and she said, I'm ready to sell it now. So it's a good thing I was on the credit union board because we got the loan through them. And we paid it off last year sometime. So they only did 15-year loans. So it was turned out pretty nice for us. To pay off, you know, a house. I don't think either one of us had ever got that close.
I think I remember when that happened, when you paid it off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's nice, you know, to just have taxes and insurance.
And how did Melrose sort of treat you as a community?
Well, we were in a parade, a couple of years ago, and we were marching, in memory of Sherry and Kathleen, who had gotten killed in a motorcycle accident. And we carried a big sign, and there were probably 20, 25 of us, you know. And some guy along the street said, well, I knew they were here, but I didn't know there were that many. So... I think they probably always, because Corky and Pat and all those gals were here early on, I think. This is where we met.
The Lee House.
Lee House, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Pink House.
The Pink House?
Patty Christensen had a house. On Wimoway, with Ellen Allen.
Yeah, I remember, on Wimoway, yeah.
Wimoway.
I don't think I ever saw the house. That's what she named that street.
Right.
Called her and said, well, she was doing some kind of insurance or something. They said, what's the address? And the street didn't have a name. And she says, Wimoway. Veronica brought a sign out and put it up. So
that's really funny.
So she's moving back. I think she's gotten the judgeship in Palatka. And she's moving back to Lee House, I hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a woman who
Gorky brought out when she was...
Yeah, when she was just...
Knee-high
her mother told her, I'm never going to bring any people down to visit you.
Yeah, there it sort of seems to be that the legend I was thinking yesterday, how Melrose came to be sort of a community of a lot of...
I think Corky met them at the bus station, the airports,
and she was the ambassador.
She was good. She populated the place.
Did she entice the people who you bought the house from?
Yeah, Dory and Corky used to be together. And Corky and just about everybody we knew. We were at a party one night, and it was Corky's 50th birthday, and everybody standing in a circle, and everybody was going to say something about every other one of them. Says, well, when I was with Corky, came to us and we said, we've never been with Corky.
There were about 100 women there.
Yeah.
It was great.
It was so funny because every other woman seemed to say, well, when I lived with Corky.
Right. Yeah, and she had a girlfriend at the time, and when... There, everybody was giving her wishes.
Yeah.
When it came to her, she says, I wish you're monogamy. Everybody cracked up.
I don't know
they
that
didn't
that
last
ever if she couldn't stay in one space with Kate, then who's the sweetest person you'd ever meet? I don't think it'll ever happen. We accused her of meeting, at the bus station, airport.
And Flash has been here also for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a whole other segment.
Yeah.
Of
the lesbian community.
Yeah.
So what else would you like to share? What haven't we gotten to that you want to sort of tell us about?
Tell you everything.
How about spirituality? Like, did a Cherokee influence have any kind of...
In my later years, yeah, because my grandmother was full-blood Cherokee, and I got interested in her because I never got to meet her. That was my father's mother. I met my mother's mother. Her father was dead by the time I was old enough to remember whether I don't think I ever met him. And I never met his father or his mother. But my sister said she spoke very little English. And it would sound about right because the English men often came to this country without wives, and they'd see these beautiful, Native American women and snatch them right up, I guess. So, but... I would have liked to have met her because I have my mouth and my nose are somewhat shaped like hers. But I never did get to. But I don't know that there's anything else too interesting. I'm raising my 5-year-old granddaughter, who belongs to the younger daughter, who's
the wilder one.
Yeah, and she's delightful. We enjoy. Having her, we realized that we may eventually get a little too old. Last nephew and his British wife want to adopt her. And as much as I'd hate to lose her, probably that would be the best thing. Because he works and he works in oil. And he says the big accident was foolishness. I didn't have any... experience. They had one engineer on there, and they were supposed to have three. And they said, it's just stupid. Trying to cut corners, I guess, like everybody else. But But he's done that since he lived with Vi for a long time. And he told her, says, you know, I need to get a job where I'm making lots of money because I can spend lots of money. So he got into that. But my family was pretty wild, I think, unlike the girls. Because one lady, when I was about 13 or 14, we had moved to a little town called Big Sandy, which was down the road ways. But I had a woman who was a daughter-in-law to people who lived next door to us for a while. So they saw some of my sisters, you know, wildness. And she asked me, says, you're not going to be wild like your sisters were, are you? And I didn't really know what they were doing. I just knew it wasn't anything I wanted to do. And I said, I don't think so. That was an interesting turning point, too, because it pointed out things that they had done that I certainly didn't want to do. I mean, I didn't want any kids. And I didn't want to be married early. I wasn't that interested in, you know, that many. I'd have a crush every once in a while on a guy that, you know, never amounted to much. But so far as my life, other than, you know, going to college and playing music and meeting some really good friends and women in the community, that would be one thing. And the other thing would be still missing the first love of my life. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't tell why that, but I have mentioned Peggy to her. Mm-hmm. I told her that she and Peggy were the only two people I've ever loved in my life, in that manner. And she seemed, if I was so quiet, you don't know what she's thinking sometimes. So I've learned to just go along my merry way and do whatever. I enjoy the Shake Rag people and coming down and playing music sometimes and listening to other musicians. And other than that, we don't lead a really high-level, exciting life. Well, I have everything that I want. I'd like to, buy 15 more guitars just because I can't play them all in time. That's a musician's disease, not anything that's too contagious. But that's pretty much me in a nutshell.
That's it. Well, thank you for sharing these stories. It was fascinating to hear everything that you were talking about.
And the mountains were beautiful. As a child, I spent a lot of time in the mountains. And it was okay, you know. I could go up and play in the mountains all day long if I wanted to, by myself. And you couldn't do that today.
Yeah.
You couldn't have a child do that. Not even in West Virginia, probably.
Did they have like a swimming hole around?
We would dam up the creek every year. Four or five of us kids would get together and we'd cut some trees and put them down and then put mud and rocks in between and make a little dam. But somebody pointed out to us, yeah, we were building our swimming pool down below the pigs, the pigsties of the creek. That didn't bother us, and we never got sick or anything.
That's hilarious.
So, we pretty much did what we wanted. I cut a grapevine once that was in a tree and was swinging on that, and finally, on my last Tarzan swing and yell, I came out of the tree. I sprained my ankle and I had to limp home.
Oh, my goodness.
So I was a pretty, pretty energetic kid. I don't know what happened to that energy.
Did you bring your guitar pretty much everywhere you went?
No. As a matter of fact, I didn't start playing for people until, God, it was probably in my 30s. We're close to 30.
And then did you go?
Shy.
Did you do like concerts and things like that? Were you?
Well, I played it for Cherie when she had the shop. And then I played Shake-Rack for a while, but they've got so many musicians now coming in, you know, that they're adequately covered.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people are professional, and they do play professionally, so, you know, the last thing I want to do is have to get some kind of license for something. But they, you know, I was talking to Paula, or here, listening to Paula talk to somebody the other day, and how they were, you know, cracked down on places, especially if you accepted any money. Mm-hmm. But when I played here, any money that was left, I always donated back to Shakespeare. So, you know, I could spend it on foo-foo stuff, but I don't need it.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we're gonna.
Now, if you can find my six guns for me, then.